Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour's series, later on, One Man's Family and yours truly, Johnny Duller. Right now, it's episode 1 of 10 of the Adventures by Morse series story, The Cobra King Strikes Back, number 14 in the entire year-long series from April 21st, 1946.
Adventures by Morse. Carlton E. Morse presents The Cobra King Strikes Back, featuring Captain Friday.
If you like high adventure, come with me. If you like the stealth of intrigue, come with me. If you like blood and thunder, come with me.
Tonight, we are plunging toward the land of the Cobra King, toward Cambodia, which is in the jungle country of French Indochina. Cambodia, the land of the mysterious ancient folk, the land now under the sway of the cobra and the wild elephant and the tiger, the land of Oriental myth and Oriental wonder, a land to the east. To reach it from San Francisco, one travels to Hawaii, to Hong Kong, to Saigon, which is the capital of Indochina, and then through the jungles northward. This is where the Carter expedition is headed. And right now is a good time for you to meet Dr. Carter, archaeologist, scientist, explorer. Dr. Carter.
At the moment, my party and I are aboard the steamship Westphalia between Hawaii and Hong Kong. The object of this expedition into the wilds of Cambodia will be explained shortly. But right now, I want you to know the other members of my party. First, you must meet my daughter, Celia. She's especially trained by me to be a historian of this expedition. Celia, please.
Daughter, secretary, historian. That's quite an order for one girl to fulfill on one expedition.
It's all right to be flippant, my dear, but just remember, there's bitter intrigue and danger connected with this expedition.
I love danger. I eat it up.
Well, that's my daughter, Celia. The second member of my party you must know is Professor Ernst LeBrun, medical advisor and scientific technician. Professor LeBrun, my friend.
Dr. Carter.
I was just remarking that I feel I've added greatly to our expedition's chances of success by persuading you to become a member of my party.
Oh, if I did not have confidence in your abilities to lead such an expedition to a successful conclusion, I doubt if you would have persuaded me.
A mutual admiration society, huh?
Mademoiselle Celière, your father is a wonderful man, and I don't doubt he'll bring this whole business off with flying colors.
Well, you've more confidence than I have, then. And now, where's Perry Mills?
Here, Doctor.
Oh, so you are, so you are. Now, Perry, besides being an admirable young man, is business manager and assistant collector for the trip. I hope and pray, young man, you didn't leave any of our paraphernalia on the dock back at San Francisco.
I certainly hope and pray so myself. I've checked and double-checked.
And triple-checked. Honestly, Father, Perry's done nothing since we left San Francisco but rummage around among our effects down in the hold of the ship.
Well, I gotta face your father when we unload at Saigon, and I want to face him with everything in order and ready to start for our expedition into the back country.
And now the last member of our party, Taquan.
Well, you let him go to his stateroom, Father.
Oh, that's right, I did.
What's the matter, seasick?
Mm-hmm. Squeamish.
Queer fish.
Oh, a brilliant scholar, aggravated by the superstitions of his people, but brilliant.
Well, all Chinese are superstitious, aren't they?
My dear, Taquan is not Chinese.
Well, Oriental.
Yes, Oriental. Taquan, Celia, is a pure descendant of the ancient Khmers, a dead race. And it's from this vanished people that the last member of our party's descended. You will hear more of Taquan.
But unknown to Dr. Carter and his group, there is a second party aboard the Westphalia, steaming westward under the great golden moon. The mission of this latter group is a carefully guarded secret, a dangerous secret. Heading it is Captain Bart Friday. Accompanying him is his fellow operative, Skip Turner, and his secretary, Patricia Young. And then there's a fourth member of the party, a figure of mystery, a prisoner. Two expeditions, and at the moment, each unaware of the other's presence on the ship. Each unaware that it has friends in the other party. And now darkness has settled on the vessel, throbbing under its pounding propellers. The moon is riding high, is gigantic, is golden. And on the main deck, Perry Mills and Celia Carter are leaning against the rail.
Oh, a lovely, lovely moon on the water.
First trip at sea, Celia?
Oh, yes. Imagine me going way off to such a wilderness as Cambodia. Clear around the world from San Francisco.
Ah, lucky girl, all right. You know, I feel rather lucky myself to be Dr. Carter's assistant archaeologist.
Dad's a dear.
Well, thank you, my dear.
Hey, where did you pop from, Father?
Evening, Dr. Carter.
Evening, Perry. Celia, Professor LeBrun will join us in a moment. Then we'll go into the main salon for a short conference. Bring your shorthand book.
Yes, Dad.
Hey, where's Taquan?
Still in his stateroom. He's having a bad time with his seasickness. He wished to retire.
You say he's Oriental, but not Chinese.
That's right. Taquan is a pure descendant of the ancient Khmers, that race that built such marvels as the Angkor Wat.
Angkor Wat, which means Temple of Angkor.
That's a good literal translation, Perry. You see, some 2,000 years ago, this race of Khmers arose to mighty strength.
A civilization sufficient unto itself.
Quite right, Perry. The kingdom grew until it must have held some, 30 million souls. They built great wats, or temples. They had trained armies and a remarkable background, both historical and mythological. In fact, they had everything that should have made them a lasting nation.
And yet 30 million people vanished from the face of the earth.
That's exactly the word, vanished. When Angkor Wat was first discovered some 80 years ago by the Frenchman Muot, it looked as though the entire population had one day laid down their implements, walked out, never returned.
But what did happen to them?
If we knew, my dear, we'd not be on this expedition.
And we're going to Angkor Wat to see what we can find.
We is good.
Well, I'm part of the expedition, for goodness sake.
Of course you are, my dear. Yes, we're going into the old Khmer realm. But we're not going to stop at Angkor Wat. That particular region has been milked dry of information. Further to the north, however, are other abandoned cities, some of which have been recently discovered, others of which are, well, are only known to exist by rumors and legends.
And we're going to hunt for one of those legendary cities?
Well, something like that. Only it isn't going to be quite such a hopeless proposition. That's where Taquan comes into the picture.
I wondered about him.
Professor LeBrun picked him up over at the University of California. His brilliant mind so attracted LeBrun that he struck up an acquaintance and discovered that Taquan was a descendant of the Khmers and had only recently come from Saigon, the French capital in the east.
He's an interesting chap, all right.
Yes, it seems that he'd come in from the agricultural region and nothing more than a breechcloth, and he demanded to be taught. He was turned over to a French parochial mission. Fathers dressed him and taught him. His brilliance delighted them, so they laid aside an allowance to send him to the University of California.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I remember the day LeBrun brought him to see you, Dr. Carter.
Yes, the professor knew I was interested in the Cambodia problem, and so he brought Taquan to see me. Developed that he knew the region north of Angkor Wat unusually well. In fact, knew of a city back in the wilderness that has not yet been discovered by explorers.
Well, well, a little lecture in Cambodian archaeology.
Oh, there you are, LeBrun.
Oh, as you say, here I am. There we all are. All except our little Khmer. Where is he?
He's not receiving visitors. Having a little private trouble with the old Devil Sea.
Sorry I was delayed, the doctor, but coming up the companionway, the most amazing thing happened to us.
Very unpleasant, I hope.
Quite the opposite. Who do you think I bumped squarely into?
You met someone you know.
I say, what depth of discernment.
You're making fun of me.
Oh, really, I am not. I did meet an old friend, a very brilliant fellow. None other than Captain Friday.
Say, you don't mean the Captain Friday in charge of the Worth murders and the City of the Dead mystery.
Remember him, do you, Perry? The very same Captain Friday.
And you just ran into him tonight? Oh. Isn't that rather peculiar, LeBrun?
Not at all, Doctor. You see, he and his party boarded the ship at Honolulu last night.
Well, what on earth is he doing on his way to Hong Kong?
Oh, most mysterious. I had to tear myself away to join you folks. Or perhaps I would have found out. He's waiting down in the salon for us to join him.
Well, that's a pleasant surprise. We'll just postpone our conference until tomorrow. Celia, we won't need you tonight after all.
All right. Then I'll stay right out here on deck and soak up some more moonlight.
Don't you want to come along and join us?
Me go down there and sit around in a cloud of cigar smoke while half a dozen men hold the floor? I should say not.
Wise girl.
Hey, don't lean too far over the rail. We don't want to lose our historian this early.
Good night, everyone.
And we'll take this companionway.
Captain Friday said the main salon. Ah, oui. Here we are. Oh, go ahead, Dr. Carter.
Oh, so you brought them down. Well, this is a great meeting.
Skip Turner, you here too.
Howdy, Professor LeBrun. Sure, I'm here. Playing guard of honor for Captain Friday and his secretary, Patricia.
But I say, Captain, who's running your agency back in San Francisco, eh?
Oh, I rather think it'll get along somehow for a while without skipping me.
Dr. Carter, this is Captain Bart Friday.
My pleasure, Captain.
And this is Mr. Skip Turner, Captain Friday's right-hand man.
Glad to know you.
Captain Friday, this is Perry Mills, Dr. Carter's assistant.
How do you do, Mills?
And Skip Turner.
Say, this is great. Well, sit down, gentlemen. Draw up some chairs. Here's some cigars. There now.
Captain, if it isn't a state secret, what on earth are you and Skip doing here so far off your beats?
Well, Professor, as a matter of fact, it comes very nearly being just that. State secrets.
Well, you don't say.
I wouldn't care to have our business made general knowledge on shipboard.
Oh, by no means. I retract my question.
Oh, no, no. That isn't at all necessary. I intended to tell you. It's a very unusual story. And rather fits in with your own work.
Something to do with the Anchor region?
Quite a bit. I've got a prisoner aboard this ship.
Prisoner? Oh. Murderer?
Bloodthirsty young peacock.
Well, there's not so wrong at that. The last man who tried to keep him in chains got himself strangled.
Strangled?
With a wet silk cord.
An Indian thuggy trick.
It isn't pleasant. I'd rather have them use a sharp knife myself.
On board the Trans-Pacific liner Westphalia, two groups of people have met. One headed by Dr. Carter, archaeologist. The other headed by Captain Friday, private operator. Captain Friday is telling about a prisoner he has taken to Saigon, French Indochina, the same port from which Dr. Carter is launching his expedition. Captain Friday has just said,
I've got a prisoner aboard this ship. His last keeper was strangled. He's an international plotter, a troublemaker.
Well, looks like you're getting into big business, Captain Friday.
After a manner, perhaps. He's a subject of Cochin China. I'm taking him to Saigon, the French capital.
Remarkable. You're going right into our territory.
Yes. But there's a closer relationship between your scientific expedition and my little party than that, Dr. Carter. Of course, you know the story of how France got hold of the Cambodia territory.
Yes. Moule, the Frenchman, when he discovered the ruins, carried the word back to France. And by being on their toes, French diplomats took the territory over before the rest of the world learned of the Khmer ruins.
Fast workers, huh?
Any nation would have jumped at the chance to get French into China, had they known about it.
Yes, it was a rich land, lying fallow for someone to take it.
After all, Mr. Turner, Siam was in no position to investigate the Cambodia ruins, even had she known of them. France immediately opened this new and rich scientific field.
All right, I'm squelched. I take it back.
Well, Skip doesn't want to argue the point. Captain Friday, suppose you continue.
Well, as you just explained, France got Cambodia by means of a diplomatic coup. It didn't set well with a lot of people in that region, especially those with the Siamese leaning. Many felt that Siam had lost a vast treasure.
But France has gotten little return for the amount of money expended in that territory. To date, anyway.
That's true, Mills. And yet there's much dissatisfaction.
Well, that's easily explained. There are innumerable legends of tremendous Khmer treasure which are supposed to be buried beneath the ruins of those old cities.
Treasure? You mean casks of gold and jewels?
Oh, no, much more fascinating loot than that. For instance, there's supposed to be a huge emerald Buddha seated on a golden coiled cobra. Numerous golden Buddhas, altar furnishings, priests and king's regalia, golden lions, golden howdahs and chairs.
My word, Perry, that is a lot of
Well, I'm only reciting from the legends. According to the myths, the Thais Vandals came down from the north in great hordes and overran Cambodia. To save their treasures of the palaces and temples, priests buried them beneath the cities with the aid of slaves. Afterwards, the slaves were slaughtered.
Jolly sort of folk, these Khmers.
All these rumors are probably at the bottom of the dissatisfaction. Anyway, a certain Cambodian element feel that they've been robbed. Up until the time the French missionaries entered the field and began to educate them, the resentment was unorganized and latent. They were ignorant, had no idea how to go about revenging themselves.
Yeah, the old story.
Yes, Dr. Carter. But French fathers continued to educate the people. The French government even assisted their efforts with appropriations. They selected brilliant Cambodian youths and gave them what corresponds to a high school education right in Saigon. Then they selected the brightest of their pupils and sent them to American and European universities.
Hey, we have just such a student in our party.
What's that, Mills?
Sure, a chap named Taquan.
Well, we have another locked in Skip's cabin.
Extraordinary, Captain Friday. You mean a Cambodian college graduate has become an international criminal?
Hardly that, Doctor. He's a representative of the rebellious element in Cambodia. He's been in the United States trying to raise a secret expedition to penetrate the jungles north of the city of Angkor, claiming that he knows the location of another of the lost Khmer cities.
Say, you don't suppose...
Oh, I say, Perry, let's not speculate, huh? Speculation's bad business.
Sure, of course. Excuse me for breaking in, Captain Friday.
It looks as though I'm telling you a story you already know.
You mind telling us who this chap is you two have in handcuffs?
Not at all. A fellow called Fen Lo.
Never heard of him. Have you, Dr. Carter?
I don't recall the name. Please go on, Captain.
Well, it appears that Fen Lo has been telling that he knows the location of this new city's buried treasures.
Rather odd. He didn't dig it up for himself and his friends, then, isn't it?
According to his story, it'll take many men and some very modern evacuation machinery to get at it.
That corresponds with the legends. The priests are supposed to have filled the passages leading down to the treasures with rock and a sort of cement.
But they wouldn't have to tunnel in the original passage. Couldn't they dig in the earth paralleling the rocked-in part?
No, Perry. It's too big a job for the natives. Even so, the treasure room would undoubtedly be cased in by a wall many feet in thickness.
Yeah, but look here. If there's all this treasure under these cities, why don't the French government dig for it?
That's just the point, Skip. The French are not convinced that there is any treasure. It's all rumor and native legend. They're not willing to spend the great sums necessary to excavate on the mere chance of finding something.
And another thing. France hasn't had the money to put into such work, not under present conditions. In the meantime, she doesn't want other people nosing around too closely. By the way, Dr. Carter, how did you ever get permission to take an expedition into the country?
By agreeing to turn over 90% of anything we should run across to the French government.
Don't seem like that'd be very profitable.
This is a scientific expedition, not a treasure hunt. Frankly, Captain Friday, I'm quite dubious about there being any treasure.
I see. Well, anyway, the French government heard about Fenlow's activities in the United States and demanded his apprehension. We caught him in San Francisco and turned him over to the French consulate. A French attaché was started on the trip with him to Saigon. En route to Honolulu, the Frenchman was murdered.
You don't say.
By Fenlow?
No. Now, Fenlow was manacled to his birth. The attaché was killed on the aft deck, strangled with a cord.
Aha, the worthy Fenlow had friends aboard.
If he did, they were never apprehended. Fenlow was taken from the ship at Honolulu, and the French consulate, unwilling to subject another of its attachés to a like fate, called for a couple of volunteers to escort the fellow the rest of the way to Saigon.
And you and Skip Turner responded.
Well, I'll say we did. A 2.5 months vacation, and all expenses paid.
Every peace officer in San Francisco volunteered. Well, finally, they put me in charge, and I selected Skip to come along. We picked up Fenlow in Honolulu and boarded their ship. And that's the story.
But Mr. Turner mentioned your secretary, Captain.
Oh, yes. I promised her she could come along on the next case. I didn't know, though, it would take us halfway around the world.
But weren't you afraid to have her come after, well, after what happened to the French attaché?
You don't know our secretary, Mr. Mayo.
Skip's right. Patricia's perfectly capable of taking care of herself. However, she's in no danger. It's quite apparent that the whole object of the attaché's death was the release of Fenlow. If there are any attacks on my party, it certainly won't be against my secretary.
A remarkable story, Captain Friday. A remarkable story.
Doubly so, since our paths have crossed.
Captain, I think I'll take a look in the cabin. I want to give the only Cambodian in captivity the once-over.
All right, Skip. Skip's as nervous as a cat. He believes there's something mysterious about our Oriental.
All Orientals or just Fenlow?
Well, Skip Turner's philosophy says that an Oriental at your back is a dangerous Oriental.
Oh, the death of the French attaché probably has a good deal to do with his uneasiness.
Very likely, Professor. Fenlow has been in a sort of cold rage since we picked him up in Honolulu. Prophesies innumerable deaths to pay for the outrage to his person. Well, everything's gone smoothly so far.
Listen.
What's the matter, Mills?
Thought I heard someone call out.
I don't hear anything.
All sorts of queer creaks and groans on a steamship. I remember...
Listen. Someone's running.
Captain Friday, the prisoner's gone.
Fenlow's escaped?
Yeah, look at the handcuffs.
Incredible. Fantastic. My word. Did he do that? Scrape the flesh off his hands, forcing them through the manacles?
He did, and he had someone to help him.
There's no doubt about that. He couldn't have done this to himself alone.
Pieces of flesh still clinging to the manacles.
You're certain about that, Captain Friday? I've seen some strange and terrible things take place in the East.
Dr. Carter, I don't believe there's a man in existence that could have gotten out of those handcuffs alone. His hands were cuffed behind him and fastened to his bunk. And I saw to it that the cuffs were tight to his wrists.
Sure, he couldn't have got away without help. But hadn't we better get on his trail?
I don't think there's any hurry, Skip. He can't escape from the ship, and we're still a good number of days from Saigon.
But if the French attaché was murdered...
The first thing to do is to inform the master of the ship. He'll warn everybody aboard to remain in his cabin, then form a searching party. I'll attend to that myself. Please excuse me.
Yes, of course.
Now, look here, Dr. Carter. Supposing I go give Celia an earful of this and send her to her cabin if she's still on deck.
Good idea, Perry. Tell her to keep to her stateroom and keep door and portholes locked.
Yeah, I certainly will.
Oh, that lad does crave excitement. Up to now, the party's been just fish and beans to Perry. But now, things are looking up a bit.
A mighty fine youngster.
Oh, but I'll tell you.
Okay, man. I just happened to think of Captain Friday's secretary. Patricia ought to be warned.
Oh, by all means. Don't hang back on our account. We'll survive somehow.
Yeah, I don't know whether you will or not if you get in the road of that there Fenlow guy.
Oh, I say, Dr. Carter.
Yes, Laverne?
Now that we're alone, what odds will you give that our own little Khmer playmate, Takwan, hasn't got a finger in Penlow's pie?
Be careful, Laverne.
Uh-huh. Right the first guess.
I'm afraid so. The chances are that Takwan and Fenlow are close friends. Both of them have been sent to American universities by French missionaries.
Oh, undoubtedly.
And take care, Professor. Don't put the idea into Captain Friday's head. If Taquan becomes mixed up with the authorities, we may never get him farther than Saigon. Our expedition is hopeless without him to guide us.
Are you certain Captain Friday doesn't already suspect?
I've been afraid of it.
In fact, I have a hunch that he went to Taquan's stateroom on his way to organize the searching party.
Do you think so?
I do.
Perhaps we'd best go see for ourselves. Now, come along with me.
If he is guilty, I hope he had sense enough to get back in his cabin after his escapade.
And I hope our suspicions are wrong.
And still the ship plows on.
Taquan's cabin's this way.
Righto. Well, anyway, the moon is still grinning down at us.
Doctor, quick, we've got to do something.
Oh, I say,
you don't understand. Celia's gone.
My daughter's gone?
Yes, she's gone. I can't find her anywhere.
Come, old chap, you look ghastly.
I feel ghastly.
Oh, look here. Why should you?
Why should I? Didn't you hear me say that Celia's disappeared? That maniac Khmer loose and roaming the deck? Suppose he's found her.
But why do you want to suppose that?
But the fellow's loose and Celia's gone.
Come on, both of you. We'll get the captain.
Just a moment, Dr. Carter. Now, look here, Perry. Are you going off half-cocked, or do you know what you're talking about?
Oh, I tell you, it's true. Every word of it's true.
Where have you looked?
Everywhere. I've been on both decks. I've been in all the salons. I even went into a cabin.
Was it unlocked?
Yes, I... What's that?
Quiet, Perry. It's coming from the lower deck. Do you recognize that?
No, Doctor. What is it?
It's an ancient Khmer death chant.
Death chant.
No!
There. What did I tell you?
Got to move on. It's Celia.
Thank you.
You have just heard the opening episode of The Cobra King Strikes Back, the newest adventure thriller by Carlton E. Morse. Adventures by Morse bring you new excitement week after week. Next week brings you the second episode, laid in Saigon, that weird and wonderful seaport of Cochin China, known as the French capital of the East. The deadly shadow of the ancient Cobra King already has fallen upon both the party headed by Dr. Carter and that led by Captain Friday. But not until the two groups land on the shores of French Indochina does the deadly force of evil descend in all its venom. Watch for next week's episode entitled Something About the Hooded Snake.
Adventures by Morse on Tuned to Yesterday, episode 1 of 10 of The Cobra King Strikes Back from April 21st, 1946. This is an hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. That last episode from the pen of writer and creator Carlton E. Morse, and as entertaining as that adventure series was, probably his most famous radio show was a serial called One Man's Family, a radio drama often referred to as a soap opera. It was one of radio's longest-running series from 1932 through 1959. We pick up on the first of 10 parts of the program from September 25th, 1950 on NBC. It's The Book of Teddy, Book 78, Chapter 17.
One Man's Family, brought to you every weekday night at this time, transcribed by Bactine, a remarkable new family antiseptic and germicide, another fine, dependable product of Miles Laboratories, makers of Alka-Seltzer. Overheard between mother and father Barber late at night in the bedroom.
You awake, Fanny?
Hmm?
Wake up and talk to me, Fanny. I've got something on my mind.
Oh, Henry.
Huh? Oh, all right, then I'll fight it out alone.
Mm-hmm. So that's how it is with the Barbers today. Chapter 16, Book 78. And now in Seacliff, San Francisco, it is well after midnight. And in the Barber family home, there are two wakeful people. Teddy, lying in her bed in the darkness, sees again in her mind's eye the shabby old house in San Rafael, which Elwood Giddings, her fiancé, bought without consulting her. And down in the master bedroom, another party to that purchase is also wakeful. Henry Barber hasn't closed his eyes. He turns restlessly, looks at Fanny, sound asleep beside him, and sighs.
Henry?
You're awake, Fanny?
Well, I am now. What is it, Henry?
Fanny.
Well?
Fanny, when Teddy came back from inspecting the house in San Rafael, she seemed quite cheerful, don't you think?
Well...
When I said there's lots you can do to that house, she admitted it, eh? Yes, yes, I think she saw possibilities over there. Yes, I'm sure she did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you talk to her before she leaves for the hospital in the morning, you do something for me, will you, Fanny?
Mm-hmm.
You tell her that fixing up old houses can be a fascinating hobby. Yes, you explain all that to her, friend.
Of course,
I wouldn't have urged Elwood to buy that house if I thought for a moment that Teddy didn't like it.
Teddy's preference didn't cross your mind, Henry. You and Elwood were buying the dental office out in front. You weren't thinking of Teddy at all.
Yes, perhaps she was a little disappointed.
She loathed it, Henry, just as I said she would.
Yes.
Oh, now, please, go to sleep.
You go back to sleep, Fanny, and I'll fight it out alone. I haven't closed my eyes. Heard everything that's happened since 10 o'clock. Sirens on the boulevard, airplanes overhead, ships at sea, surf on the shore, birds, heard it all. I keep seeing that little house. But it's no trick to fix broken pickets or put on new shingles, or there's nothing to that, but... A little paint would do wonders.
Henry, would you like me to go and get you some hot milk?
Yes, yes. That'll be nice of you, Fanny. There's somebody at the door. Yes, yes. Who is it?
You two all right?
Oh, Clifford.
Yes, yes.
Heard you talking in here, and I met Teddy in the hall. Everybody seems to be recognized.
What's Teddy doing?
She couldn't sleep either. She's down in the kitchen making milk toast.
Yes, yes. My rope, please, Clifford. Hand me my rope.
Oh, Henry, don't go down and talk to her now.
Now, you stay right there, my dear. Go back to sleep. I'll get my own hot milk. Now, where are my slippers?
There they are, Dad.
Yes, sir.
Almost 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, Dad.
Well, we can all sleep late tomorrow. Now, you close your eyes, Fanny. I hope I didn't disturb you.
Oh, that man.
Hmm?
You see, his conscience bothers him.
No. What about?
Oh, he pushed Elwood into buying that terrible house before Teddy saw it. She's just heart sick.
Yeah.
Henry knows whose fault it is.
Dinner, I thought Terry looked as if somebody had hit her a good hard poke in the stomach.
Clifford, put that window down a little, will you? There's a cool, damp breeze.
Okay. Maybe I'll go downstairs and have a snack myself.
Oh, Clifford, wait until your father comes back up. He was just looking for a chance to talk to Teddy alone. Oh, now you've stayed down there in the kitchen so long, I'll have to get up and go back.
So you're in the kitchen too, Teddy. Well,
Father Barber.
Yes, Teddy. I thought I'd have some hot milk.
Well, there's some on the stove. Want me to pour it?
No, you sit right there. Finish a bowl. I know where everything is. So excited about your house and wedding and all, you couldn't sleep either, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I know how you feel. When Fanny and I got married, we moved into a modest place, and we were just as excited and happy as if it were a mansion.
Would you like me to make you some toast?
No, I'll sit here with you and just sip a cup of milk. Yeah, not really hungry. I suppose that you and Edward talked about plans for your house all evening, eh, Teddy?
No, not very much.
You find it's great fun to remake up an old house, Teddy. Why, almost every month in the magazines there are articles about the joy of transforming old houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, take two young people in love, a can of paint, a sack of cement, a flat of flowers, and their dreams, and they can do wonders, Teddy. See?
Oh, I didn't say anything.
Oh. Teddy?
Yes?
I hope you weren't put out with Elwood for buying that house before you saw it. He consulted me, you know, Teddy.
Yes.
Relied on my judgment.
Yes, Father Barber, I know.
Yes. You see, Elwood looks up to me, Teddy. Yes, respects my judgment. And in business matters, I can be very forceful. Now, don't tell me that you quarreled with Elwood.
No.
Act peaked, though?
I don't know how I acted.
I've had women displeased with me, too, in my time.
Have you really?
Oh, yes, many times. They withdraw.
They do?
Yes, become polite. I presume you became polite with Elwood this evening?
Probably.
You girls can be devastating, Teddy. The flip of the skirt, toss of the head, the frigid politeness, and a man is reduced to a bowl full of jelly.
You make it sound dreadful.
Well, the male is difficult, too, sometimes. Oh, Teddy, hand me that pad and pencil there.
Hmm.
Yes, I want to show you something. Thank you. I'll make a little sketch here.
What?
Now, here's your picket fence. Here's your little stucco dental office. Here's the brown lawn. And the bungalow in back.
What's this for?
You wait. I remember, some years ago, a young couple named Winters, Joel and Sarah Winters. Oh, they weren't too young, about your age and Elwood Wilson. They moved into a ramshackle little bungalow that hadn't been painted in half a century. Shingles off the roof, and pickets gone from the fence, boardwalk. Oh, a very sad place. But they busied themselves weekends and evenings, put in flower beds, painted the house, and created a home, Teddy. And all that time, what was happening to them, eh? Every blessed creative thing they did brought them closer together. Yes. It isn't the final accomplishment that makes life worth living. It's the challenge, the struggle. Yes. The good Lord didn't put us here because he thought it would be good for us to have things easy. That's the trouble with the whole world today. Everybody wants life to be like a motion picture. All fingernail polish and never a hair out of place.
Are you lecturing me, Father Butler?
No, I'm just talking. Elgin, now look at the picture I've drawn here. Now we've put the pickets back in the fence, you see? And here is green, shiny ivy growing over the dental office. And here, a flagstone walk and a new lawn and a bright green front door and flower boxes. Yeah. How's that for a house?
It would cost a lot, though.
The flowers are free. They'll come from my own garden.
Well, yes, but the paint and the flagstone.
Betty, I have an embarrassment of paint in the basement, and I don't know what to do with all my leftover paint. Brushes, too, everything.
Green and white house would be very pretty.
Wouldn't it? Now, in the flagstone. I was telling my gardener, Arnie Gans, today. I wanted Arnie to tear up the flagstones on the lower terrace and put in a brick walk. Yes, so you and Elwood can have those flagstones. You're welcome to them. You'll do me a favor if you take them away.
Well, maybe that old place does have possibilities.
Possibilities? Why, it can be a dream house, Teddy. Yes, but they'll run before and after pictures of it in Sunset Magazine first thing you know.
Father Barber.
And how about a blue and white breakfast look? Eh? Yes, it wouldn't cost much. Why, Teddy, you haven't begun to fix that place up. Enlarge the front windows. Change the lines. Paint the roof. Add a porch. Little red brick wall instead of the picket fence.
Oh, Father Barber.
You can see it now? Yes, by Teddy. It's a charming house. It's a prize winner.
You know something. I guess I've been acting pretty darn childish about this whole thing. I wanted everything to be perfect to start with.
Oh, what's the fun in that?
I'm glad you came down to talk to me.
Henry, when are you coming back to bed?
Oh, we're both coming up right now, Mother Barber.
Yes, Teddy.
You know, Mother Barber, I hadn't realized what a wonderful house that can be.
Yes, yes, Teddy. It's a beautiful place.
What house are you talking about?
Our new house. The house in San Rafael.
Hmm?
Yes, yes. Run along now, Teddy. Oh, by George, it's almost 2:30. Run along. Let us all go to bed.
All right, Father Barber. Good night. Good night, Mother Barber.
Good night, Teddy. See you in the morning. Henry, what's been happening down here?
Oh, we were just talking. You worried needlessly, Fanny. I said all along that she saw the possibilities in that place in San Rafael.
I wonder, though. I wonder if she's trying to convince herself or to make you feel less guilty.
Here's the family again.
Fanny, are you asleep?
What is it now, Henry?
Do you suppose that Teddy was only pretending to be enthusiastic about fixing up that house and really doesn't like it?
Henry, that's what I've been trying to tell you. Don't you ever listen to anything I say. Now go to sleep.
One Man's Family is brought to you every weekday night at this time, transcribed by Miles Laboratories, makers of vaccines.
One Man's Family, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 25th of September 1950 on NBC. We now close out this hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday with the first of a five-part story on yours truly, Johnny Dollar. It was a Monday afternoon on CBS when they aired part one of five of the Chesapeake fraud matter on October 17th, 1955.
From Hollywood, it's time now for Bob Bailey as...
Johnny Dollar.
Hi. Pat Kelleher, Universal Adjustment Bureau.
Good to hear your voice, Patsy. Thought you were transferred to Baltimore.
That's where I am. Say, John, can you handle one for me?
What kind of one?
It's a life and accident policy. Eastern Fidelity paid off 5 years ago. A man named John Reardon was the insured party. He died in 1950. Wife was a beneficiary. It's a crazy one.
Well, go on.
Eastern wants us to look into the matter QT. One of their officers has reason to believe Reardon is still alive.
Why would he think that?
Because he saw him 2 days ago.
I'll get the first plane.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Universal Adjustment Bureau, Baltimore, Maryland. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Chesapeake fraud matter. Expense account item one, $22.75, plane fare and incidentals, Hartford to Baltimore. I arrived at 3:15 in the afternoon at Friendship International Airport. It was a cold, gray day. I took a cab directly to Pat Kelleher's office.
Good to see you, John.
He was 10 pounds heavier. Outside of that, he looked swell.
We'll have to have dinner once you meet my wife. Where are your bags? You didn't go to a hotel.
I checked my stuff at the airport, Patsy. I didn't know how long I'd be here. Over the Alleghenies on the plane, I got to thinking about the number of alive but dead reports I've investigated at one time or another. They happen all the time, but they never pan out.
Yeah, well, this one isn't like that, John. Sit down.
Thanks.
You know, and a man like Paul Coombs, chairman of the board for Eastern Fidelity, not to mention vice president of two oil companies and one construction company, when he romps in here and says somebody's still alive, it's supposed to be dead, we got to listen to him.
Sure you do, Pat. It's your job.
Your job now. Coombs claims he not only saw Reardon, but talked to him. I'll go into that later. Policy was issued in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And wife's a beneficiary.
Yeah. Elizabeth Jane Reardon. $10,000.
$20,000, John. Double indemnity on the accident clause.
Oh. Well, look, I'll look at this stuff later. Maybe you better tell me about that first.
Okay. John Reardon was lost in a boat accident out on Chesapeake Bay.
When?
August 13th, 1950. There were four people in the party. They went out for the afternoon on a power cruiser, and the thing exploded in the middle of the bay.
Oh, yeah, I may have read about it. Was there a man named Sharpston involved?
Yeah. Sharpston owned the boat. He and his wife were aboard, and another man named Blaine.
Did all of them go down?
That's right. They recovered Mr. and Mrs. Sharpston's body and Blaine's. They never found John Reardon.
What caused the explosion?
No explainable reason. It was never determined.
Oh, there's always a reason.
Yeah, well, that probably blew up with the boat, too. As it happened, we conducted the investigation for Atlantic States Limited. They held the insurance on the Sharpstons and the boat. These are our findings in the matter. We found no reason for Atlantic not to honor the claim made by Sharpston's estate.
Mm-hmm. How about the other man who was killed, Blaine?
His case was adjusted by another company.
So that leaves us John Reardon.
Yeah. About a month after the accident, his wife filed claim for payment. Our investigation was ended by then. We notified the insurance commission of the circumstances of his death and requested a judgment.
13. Did it go through all right?
Yeah. The appellate court declared John Reardon legally dead after the required 3-year waiting period. Pretty standard when there's no body.
Sure.
Eastern honored the claim and paid Mrs. Reardon $20,000. So, that's about it.
Except that now somebody thinks he's alive.
Not just somebody. Paul Coombs.
Yeah. And if that's so, Eastern's been swindled for $20,000. Tell me about the beneficiary.
Miss Reardon?
Mm-hmm.
Nice woman. Met her a couple of times. She didn't need money, I can tell you that much.
Oh?
Yeah, worth over $200,000. Never married again.
You say she didn't file her claim until a month after the accident.
That's right.
She ever give any reason for waiting that long?
Well, she was pretty broken up about it. The money wasn't important particularly. Maybe she just forgot.
Pat, I've got a question.
What's that, John?
How can you forget $20,000? Expense account item 2, $10, for drinks I had with Pat Kelleher while we talked some more about the Reardon case. At 7 o'clock that night, I had on a fresh shirt and a press suit. They seemed to impress Paul Coombs, vice president, chairman of boards, etc.
Dollar?
That's right, Mr. Coombs, Universal Adjuster.
Oh, yes, of course. Come in. I talked with Mr. Kelleher there. He sent you?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Oh, yes. I recall your name now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we can sit here, Mr. Dollar. Now, you hear about John Reardon, of course.
That's right.
I'm glad they sent a man like you. I'm glad you're the one who's going to look into it.
You puzzle me, Mr. Coombs.
No, I don't. And that's a compliment to your perceptive abilities, young man. As a matter of fact, you're here because you're only curious about me. You want to have a look at the man who thinks he saw John Reardon alive, right?
I suppose so.
You don't believe he is alive?
I didn't say that.
I admire your caution. I'm glad you're the one who's going to look into it because, well, John Reardon was a close friend of mine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, I knew him for a number of years, and Mrs. Reardon. He was a fine, sensitive man. I'm sure you'll know how to handle him when you meet him.
You sound very certain that I will meet him, Mr. Coombs.
There's no doubt in my mind about that. 3 nights ago at the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver, Colorado, I saw John Reardon. I walked up and spoke to him. I talked with him for 15 or 20 minutes. I know it was him.
He didn't admit it.
He denied it completely. He told me his name was Frank Bauer and that he had lived in Denver ever since the war.
Frank Bauer?
Yes. I was so certain it was John Reardon, I insisted. He laughed at me. Seemed good-natured about it. Even bought me a drink.
I see.
I asked him where he had lived before Denver. He said something about Toledo.
Uh-huh.
I asked him if he'd gone to college there. He told me he'd gone to Ohio State. Told me he was an engineer. a mining engineer. Everything he told me seemed plausible and reasonable, except that all the time I knew he was lying. I knew his name wasn't Frank Bowers. That was John Reardon.
How did you leave it with him?
Well, the whole thing unnerved me somewhat. I'm afraid I looked like rather a fool. I simply caught my limousine out of the airport and came back here to Baltimore.
Did you get his address in Denver?
No.
Any of his business connections, anything like that?
No.
Was he alone when you met him?
There was no one with him. At the bar, he even ordered his drink the way John always ordered it. You know, like this.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people make that signal for two fingers of bourbon.
Wore clothes the same way, too.
Have you spoken of this matter to anyone outside of Pat Kelleher?
No. No, I thought it should be looked into before I called up Elizabeth.
Elizabeth?
Elizabeth Reardon, John's widow.
Oh, yes.
It'll do no good bothering her just now.
I'm afraid she'll have to be bothered.
Why? Can't you investigate the information I've given you without upsetting everyone?
With this kind of information, somebody's bound to get upset. Look, don't put restrictions on me, Mr. Coombs, or we won't get anywhere. You say John Reardon was a close friend of yours.
Yes.
I presume his wife was, too.
That's right. A lovely, lovely person.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind when I talk to her.
Maybe you aren't the man for this.
You can get somebody else, Mr. Coombs.
No. It's just that I suddenly had a strange feeling about it all. Depressing.
If John Reardon is alive, and you seem to be certain of it, then I understand your feeling.
How's that?
Your friend's party to a $20,000 fraud, not to mention his wife. Possibly he's not as sensitive and she's not as lovely as you thought. I spent the rest of the evening with Pat Kelleher and his wife, hoping to see the bright lights and listen to some laughter. We picked a couple of fancy bistros and started the rounds to watch champagne flow and eavesdrop on the happy stories of success, promotion, and love. But it didn't work.
Like the place, John?
It's swell.
You're as low as a cricket's ankle.
Well, today a man kept telling me a friend of his was alive who's supposed to be dead. He told me what a fine fellow this friend is, or was.
Yeah.
99 times out of 100, I tell him to go jump in the lake, but Paul Coombs comes under the title reliable witness in anybody's book. Give me a match.
Here. How you fix for plans?
Start somebody looking into Frank, whatever his name is, in Denver, who's supposed to be Reardon. I'll start with a beneficiary, but...
Miss Reardon?
Yeah. I'll march out and say, let me look at some pictures of your husband. What kind of a guy was he? Did you enjoy each other or try to kill each other? Did you ever, why didn't Coombs look into it himself? Why didn't he go out to the widow and tell her about his meeting the guy in Denver?
Because he came to us, John.
Yeah, I know, Patsy. I'm sorry. But the prospect of going to somebody, anybody, with a flimsy story like that makes me sore. It might get her hopes up that her husband's alive. And that's a lousy thing to do. Reliable or not, Coombs is probably all wet.
Probably.
Sour racket.
Sour racket.
You being a parrot?
Just being agreeable, John. If you want to be sad, I'll be sad with you. We both know situations like this are part of the trade.
Oh, I should have been a... Oh, let's have another belt.
Sure. Waiter. Well, John.
Hmm?
Maybe another way to handle Mrs. Reardon with that. That's her over there at the bar. Nice, isn't she?
Hey, she is lovely. Nothing. She looks a little tight.
Yeah, well, I hear she gets that way quite a bit these days. Say, John, you want me to introduce you like a friend? It might make it easier.
No, I'll handle it myself. Who's with her?
Beats me.
He's looking for a phone booth. Pat.
Yeah?
I may be able to find out what I want and not let her know what it's about.
You mean right now?
I mean right now. Hello. You're Elizabeth Reardon, aren't you?
Oh, yes.
Well, probably you don't remember me. My name's Johnny Dollar. We met some time ago.
I'm afraid I don't remember, Mr. Dollar.
I'm in the insurance business. Don't remember?
Well, where was it we met?
Now I can't remember. May I sit down?
Well, I'm expecting someone. He'll be back in a minute. Yes.
Would you care for a drink?
I have this one, thank you.
Oh. How's John these days?
John?
Your husband, Mrs. Reardon. His name is John, isn't it?
My husband's been dead nearly 5 years.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it must be... Well, this is very awkward.
That's all right.
5 years. I could have sworn it was just 3 years ago I met you and John. In Denver.
It couldn't have been. We were never there.
Oh, well, pardon me. I sit here making bad conversation with you, and it's very apparent you're distressed. Look, I'm very sorry I upset you. Is there anything I could do?
No. No, Mr. Dolly, you didn't upset me. You look like a very nice person. How long are you going to be in Baltimore?
A few more days.
Perhaps you'll come out to the house for a drink before you go back. Say tomorrow.
Oh, I'd like that, Mrs. Reardon.
You can call me. I'm in the book.
Mrs. John Reardon?
Yes.
I will. Again, I'm sorry that I brought...
Do me a favor, Mr. Dollar. When you come to my house for a drink, call me Elizabeth. And please, don't mention my husband's name. I'd appreciate it very much if I never heard it again.
There'll be another exciting episode in our story of the Chesapeake fraud matter tomorrow.
Tomorrow, a little talk to a widow who might not be a widow at all. And a strong feeling that a smile can sometimes be more dangerous than a gun. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by John Dawson, it is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, on Tuned to Yesterday from October 17th, 1955 on CBS. And that wraps up this hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to join us next week at the same time as we continue these great shows. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. It's been a pleasure.